Hello. Well, wives, submit to your husbands. As you've probably heard, some Sydney Anglicans have drafted a wedding vow in which the bride promises to submit to the groom. But the issue goes a lot deeper than one line in a marriage service. And we'll get into that question today on the Religion and Ethics Report. Welcome to the show with me, Andrew West. In interviews with two experts, we'll ask if a conservative biblical reading of women and leadership should apply across the church, let alone outside it. And really, is the Bible clear on this issue? But first, let's go to another serious matter. A Catholic priest has been charged with two counts of so-called misprison of a felony. Police claim that Father Tom Brennan failed to report to authorities allegations of sex crimes that a fellow priest is alleged to have committed against two boys in the late 1970s. At the time, Father Brennan was the principal of St. Pius X School in Newcastle, where a man accused of sexual offences, the now former priest John Denham, taught. Father Brennan has also been charged with assault for allegedly caning the two boys when they reported the alleged offences to him. This case stirs up memories of a recent trial in the United States, where Monsignor William Lynn of Philadelphia has been sent to jail. He wasn't a sex offender himself, but he moved priests whom he knew to be offenders between the parishes, rather than reporting them to police. Dr. Andrew Morrison is a barrister, a senior counsel, and a New South Wales spokesman for the Australian Lawyers Alliance. Why is this case of Father Tom Brennan so important?
Well, to my knowledge, it's the first occasion on which a charge of misprison of felony has been laid in Australia, that is, in any of the Australian jurisdictions. Misprison of felony is an old common law offence in which Lord Denning said the offence was constituted by not going to the police or other appropriate authority with information you had as to the commission of a felony, that's a serious criminal offence, and you should tell the appropriate authority everything you know about it, including names, when it occurred, and the nature of the allegations.
And that's at the core of the allegations against Father Thomas Brennan.
Indeed.
How similar is this case of Father Brennan to a recent case in the United States, that of Monsignor William Lynn in Philadelphia?
There the charge again was not a charge of committing the offences, but of concealing them. And relevantly in respect to Father Brennan, because he's been charged with other things as well, it's identical to that case. And I understand that there's been a further senior member of the clergy charged following that conviction in the United States.
And the Monsignor Lynn case was as much about holding the hierarchy of the US Catholic Church to account as anything else. Could that be the same implication here for Australia?
I would have thought so. Take, for example, the case involving the Christian Brothers at a school in southern Sydney. And we know that Cardinal Pell says the Church has changed its ways and deals with these matters through the Towards Healing process. Well, that was a case where the Christian Brothers used the Towards Healing process. They appointed a competent and highly respectable assessor to do the assessment, Brian Moroney, a former assistant police commissioner. Brian Moroney found that the pupil had been abused by a Christian brother, that the abuse had been covered up by the year master who had been aware of it, and he was very disturbed when the Christian Brothers instructed him to stop his inquiries prior to making findings. Very disturbing.
Dr. Morrison, these alleged offences are claimed to have occurred in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Was there any legal requirement around that time for school teachers and medical doctors and such people to report cases of suspected sexual abuse?
Mandatory reporting hadn't come in at that time. But in any event, the old common law offence of misprison of felony still applied, and that meant that it was a criminal offence not to report knowledge or belief of the commission of a serious criminal offence to the police or other appropriate authority.
If this case against Father Brennan is successful, what is likely to follow? I mean, will it lead to other cases?
I'm aware, for example, that there are inquiries underway in Newcastle Maitland Diocese. You'd be aware, of course, that up there there is something like 100 victims of sexual abuse by three particular priests, one of whom was defrocked by the then bishop And that bishop, according to a leaked document which Joanne McCarthy accessed and published in the Newcastle Herald, suggested that in order to defrock the priest, he was given both the threat of potential prosecution and the promise of silence if he cooperated. That's very disturbing, and I understand that briefs to the DPP are to be sent in the near future, may indeed already have been sent.
And this concerns a serving bishop of the Catholic Church?
As I understand it, and I don't think there's any secret about it, it's the current Archbishop of Adelaide, Archbishop Philip Wilson. That's the allegation.
We have some 30 dioceses, Catholic dioceses around Australia. Could we be looking at a situation like they had recently, I think in Belgium, where just about every Catholic bishop's office was raided in an attempt to gain evidence?
I do not see why not. If senior members of the church have been aware of abuse, and we know, for example, of at least 100 cases in one diocese alone in New South Wales, and of many other dioceses in which cases are reported, and we know of all those suicides in Victoria and more in New South Wales.
What would it take to get to that point?
It needs a proper inquiry with Royal Commission type powers.
Now, your organisation, the Australian Lawyers Alliance, has called repeatedly for a Royal Commission into clerical sex abuse. Professor Patrick Parkinson of the University of Sydney, who himself has done investigations for the Catholic Church, so someone not hostile to the institution of the Church, has also called for a Royal Commission. Why do you think this is so necessary?
Because I think the problem is systemic, and I don't see any serious sign that the Church has changed its ways. The Father F case is a very good example where, first of all, the abuse takes place in one place. Father F, instead of being reported to the police, is sent on to Moree. There, he, according to his own admissions in court, abused five boys. He admits in open court to having told a meeting of three senior clergy in 1992, Fathers Usher, Peters and Lucas, about that abuse. Cardinal Pell says that they don't recall any such admission. However, Father Peters, in a report to the Bishop of Armidale 8 days after this meeting, reported that Father F wished to make certain admissions and had admitted abusing five boys. One of them, Father Lucas, on ABC Radio, admitted that admissions were made, but said that they didn't know the names of the five victims, to which my response is the fellow who, in fact, caused charges to be brought against Father F, which were dismissed, but who was himself charged with trying to blackmail Father F, charges which were dismissed when Father F admitted the abuse in open court. So they knew one of the five, but the other four, if they'd wanted to, they could have found out. Now, when you look at a case like that, you have to recognise the problem is a systemic one. Telling traumatised victims to go to the police is no substitute for the legal obligation to report serious criminal acts to the police.
So how high could the case of Father F go?
I would have thought that, for example, in that case, the Bishop of Armidale receives a report setting out explicit sexual misconduct by a priest. I would have thought that his own conduct would be the subject of investigation. So too would be any other person to whom that report was passed by him. They had a clear obligation to go to the police with the allegations.
Dr. Andrew Morrison, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Andrew Morrison, SC, from the Australian Lawyers Alliance. This is the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN with me, Andrew West. Now, way back in February, we covered on this program the proposed new service book for the Anglican Diocese of Sydney. When we read the suggested wedding vows for the bride, in which she promises to, quote, respect and submit to her husband, we knew it would cause a storm, and so it's come to pass. Battle lines have been drawn over whether the word submit plunges a church that now has three women bishops back into a patriarchal past. The Sydney Diocese, of course, doesn't have women priests, let alone bishops. The drafters of this proposed bridal wedding vow draw their inspiration from what they argue to be the biblical notion of male headship in the family and in the church. Now, many leading Anglicans disagree, and we'll hear from one in a moment. But Dr. Claire Smith is a leading conservative theologian, a founder of the Priscilla and Aquila Centre at Moore College in Sydney, and the author of the new book, God's Good Design, What the Bible Really Says About Men and Women. She explained her understanding of male headship to producer Noel Debien.
Well, it's an unusual word and one that we're not used to, I think, in our common dialogue, but it's a word that comes from the New Testament when it talks about the relationship between a husband and a wife being like that between Christ and the church, where Christ is the head of the church.
So it's a biblical word, is it?
It's a biblical word.
When you use that word headship, it is also countercultural, though, I think, given we've had a period where the rights and roles of men and women have changed quite dramatically in 100 years. It is countercultural, isn't it?
It is countercultural, and I think because of that, there is explaining to do, because as language changes and as culture changes, we have to make sure that when we say something, people are understanding what we're saying. Submission is also misunderstood, the meaning has changed, and people hear what we're not saying and what the Bible is not saying.
The word submission, it's laden with all sorts of psychological impact and all those sorts of things for us. When it comes down to it, that seems to be the word that gets people riled. For example, I know Julia Baird has written in the Herald that it's patriarchy 101, I think she called it.
The debate, the public debate recently has focused on this word submission, when actually the promises that the husband will make in a marriage are as radical, if not more radical, than this notion of submission that's causing such consternation. What the Bible is talking about is a relationship between two equals with equal dignity, but in a relationship where the husband and the wife have different responsibility and roles, if you want to use that expression, that work together in a complementary way.
Are those roles gender-based? Is that what you're saying? By design, by God's design?
Yes, certainly the way I read the scriptures, if you sit down and you read the scriptures, that is what they're saying, that God has designed the relationship between men and women, husbands and wives, in such a way that it works best when the man is leading and caring and protecting his wife, and the wife, moving away from the word submission, if you look at it as trust or deferring or accepting the leadership of the man.
I'm trying to work out how this might work out practically speaking day to day. Having been in many Sydney Anglican homes, I've watched fathers doing parenting stuff, changing a nappy. I've seen fathers taking care while, you know, mother's off doing something with family in England and is solo parent with a bunch of kids. I don't actually see a complete distinction, if you know what I mean, as I would imagine if it was wives take care of children and make the food and husbands do this. So how does it work?
Yes, well, it's not about who does what. It really is about the shape of a relationship. So, for example, in our home or in, well, every family that I know, they share tasks. That's not what this is about. This is not about drawing a line between male jobs and female jobs. It's about a way of relating and taking responsibility within the relationship.
Julia Baird, of course, as you know, grew up in the bosom of Sydney Anglicanism, now a very prominent journalist, who argues that this is patriarchy 101. This could set us all back if we're not careful about this, she's arguing.
Well, and I'd say to Julia, who I know and I count as a friend, I'd say she's misunderstanding really what the Bible is saying and what we are saying because of what the Bible is saying, which is this is not patriarchy. There is what I would call the march of patriarchy, where the man hammers out the beat and the woman is expected to just
toe the line.
Then there is what I would call the race of feminism. Essentially, there's a competition going on. Who's going to have the last word? This is about a dance between a husband and wife working together in harmony in different ways, contributing their differences, but ultimately where the man takes responsibility to lead the relationship and protect the relationship and protect his wife, and she, for her part, encourages his leadership and defers to his leadership
Can you think of an example? I mean, the Sydney Anglican women I know are pretty strong-minded people. When they're not pushovers. And when I watch them in their marriages, I don't see submissiveness in the sense that I would think submissiveness means.
This is not about being a doormat. It's not about checking in your brain or not having opinions or not contributing to the life of a family or the life of the church.
But it is connected to, I think, the way power works, because you can't be ordained a priest in the Sydney Anglican Church, can you? You could be ordained a deacon, but not a priest. You can't preach, can you?
The first bit is true.
I mean, to men. You can't preach to men, can you?
I myself choose not to preach to men. There are women in the Sydney Diocese who preach to men. There is a range of practice across the diocese. I mean, that's one of the misunderstandings that people have. I understand that although women are to contribute across so many of the fields in the church, that the ongoing formal teaching role is one that God has reserved for those few men who are appointed to do it.
So this is your own conviction from your reading of Scripture?
This is my own conviction from my reading of Scripture.
Well, that's in accord, of course, with what Roman Catholics teach about priesthood and teaching, of course.
Right.
Oddly enough.
Well, they are reading the same Bible.
You are a teacher, though. I mean, here we are. I'm a man. I'm talking to you. You're a woman. Aren't you teaching me?
Well, I hope you're learning something from what we're talking about.
I see.
I mean, the Christian life is a life of learning.
Well, what about teaching? I mean,
well,
you say you choose not to. Why not? You're very smart.
What I choose not to do is the formal, ongoing, doctrinal instruction of the gathered Christian community. So it is what we might call the sermon. It's not that women and other men are never to say anything that someone else might learn from. On the contrary.
What about those who would say to you, but Dr. Claire Smith, I'm listening to you, but I think you've got Stockholm syndrome. You have identified with your captor. How do you respond to them?
I guess really you've boxed me into a corner there, because that's the nature of Stockholm syndrome. Yeah. I mean, I think really if you've known me long enough, which you probably haven't, I'm thoughtful and opinionated and not likely to be held captive by that sort of thing. And, you know, the fact is I didn't become a Christian believing this. I became a Christian believing 180 degrees the other direction.
You were a feminist, in fact, when you started out.
Exactly. I'm the last person who thought I would be sitting here talking with you, Noel, about this.
Now, Dr. Andrew McGowan, the warden of Trinity College in Melbourne, which is, of course, a very prestigious theological faculty, he's argued quite strongly against this idea of submission being put into the marriage service, saying that, no, well, the Bible clearly teaches equality. Gentile or Jew, servant or free, woman or man, no more, but one in the Lord, he would argue. And he argues along those lines. Now, how do you respond to another Anglican who's arguing in a different way?
Oh, well, when you put it like that, I'd agree entirely with him. Of course, equal. But in these few ways that we've been talking about, with different responsibilities.
But there are those who would say, you know, there's also a passage in Ephesians that says, slaves, obey your masters with fear and trembling, and in singleness of heart as you would obey Christ. I presume we wouldn't be advocating that slaves should obey their masters well. We would say that context has now passed. Could not this argument about context be important that other Anglicans make, saying, well, see, the submission stuff about wives goes with slaves and goes with other things from a past culture?
If the teaching about men and women was just teaching about men and women in that cultural context with nothing else, I'd be prepared to say, well, it's cultural. But the reasons that are given for it aren't cultural reasons in the New Testament. The reasons that are given for it are because within the marriage relationship, it reflects the relationship of Christ and the church. They're theological reasons that don't change.
Dr. Claire Smith, theologian and author of God's Good Design, putting the conservative side of this latest debate about male headship and wifely submission to producer Noel Debien. Now, naturally, this being the Anglican Church, there's another side, there are many sides to this debate. The Reverend Dr. Andrew McGowan is a leading liberal or progressive Anglican theologian. He's also the warden of Trinity College in Melbourne. Earlier this week, he wrote in the online Jesuit magazine Eureka Street that equality within marriage is firmly based in the Bible. He says the passages that suggest male headship are framed by the social conditions of the day, which included slavery, and that they don't amount to an instruction from God. So how does he feel about the suggestion from the Diocese of Sydney that brides should promise to submit to their husbands?
I couldn't say that I was too surprised by it, although it wasn't something I was specifically prepared for. But if you'd asked me to predict what an Anglican Diocese of Sydney liturgical group would come up with for a wedding service, perhaps that is exactly what one would have expected because of the consistent emphasis given in that diocese to issues of male headship over women, both in families and in the church generally. So I suppose really it's par for the course, but disappointing if you put it against a broader backdrop of Australian social reality and indeed changes that have happened in other parts of the Anglican Church.
Now, this vow that's in the proposed service book, and it's important to say it's only going to be an option, they say it won't be compulsory, it is a vow that also requires of the husband a very sacrificial form of love, as Christ loved the church, giving of himself. What can be wrong with that?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with the husband being asked to offer a kind of sacrificial love, if that's understood properly. And one should perhaps say, just to contextualise as sympathetically as one could, that traditional Anglican prayer books have used some form of asymmetrical vow in the past. The word was not submit. The submission language, I think, involves a bit of specific modern Sydney thought, but it's true, of course, that in the Book of Common Prayer, wives were asked to vow to obey their husbands and husbands not to obey their wives. What is perhaps more surprising and disappointing from my point of view is the fact that they're perhaps a trend which is a century old and more for the church to revise a rather traditional set of patriarchal ideas to consider that the contributions of men and women in society more generally should not be related to one another in terms of inequality or power of male over female, but rather that their distinctiveness and their complementary character has to do with other things than who's in charge.
Now, that vow of obedience actually began to disappear in 1928 when there was a revision of the Book of Common Prayer. Indeed, I recall that at the marriage of Prince William and Catherine Middleton last year, there was no reference to wifely obedience in those vows.
I believe that was the case. And so Anglicans for nearly a century have been using forms of wedding service that still involved that kind of traditional language from an aesthetic point of view, but acknowledged what was already the case in the 1920s, the fact that women had begun to achieve participation in higher education, to take part in professions, to take part in all sorts of social institutions, and indeed have continued to do so since then, holding high office. So it is an odd development, as it were, that goes against the tide of a general move, both in the church itself and in the wider society, to acknowledge that the complementarity of men and women is not to be understood primarily in terms of an inequality of power.
Now, let's talk, though, about the theology of this, because the passage in Paul's letter to the Ephesians seems quite clear. Wives, be subject to your husband as you are to the Lord, because the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is the head of the church.
Yep.
That all seems pretty unambiguous, doesn't it? The scriptures seem pretty clear there.
Well, there are all sorts of things that the scripture seems to be clear about if you take a particular verse or passage out of context, but there are plenty of other passages of scripture which people don't take as immediately prescriptive for how we should be living our lives in the 21st century. This Ephesians passage is one of a number of passages in the New Testament writings which try and provide a sort of guidebook to life in the Greco-Roman world, which include instructions not only to husbands and wives as to how to relate to each other, but also to children and parents. And here's the kicker, of course, how slaves and masters are supposed to respond to one another. So this should immediately send up an alarm bell to make us ask whether, in fact, it's the actual social order that's mentioned in these texts which is really being prescribed, or whether rather the authors have something else in mind, which is how to deal with a particular social reality that you've been dealt, the hand that you've been dealt, as it were.
So your view here is, as a theologian, is that Paul was not speaking of the will of God, but as you say, giving more a commentary on the society that surrounded him.
Well, I think the author, whether it's Paul or not, is trying to work with his audience to consider what the will of God is in a given social situation, rather than to establish the way the social order itself ought to be. I think this author doesn't imagine that the prospect of a society without slavery is a possibility, and therefore takes a sort of pragmatic view of saying, well, given that there are masters and slaves, how should you exist in these circumstances? So he advocates something similar with regard to the master-slave relationship that he does for the husband-wife relationship, that they have an unequal power relationship, but that both should live it in as fair and considerate a way as possible. But it doesn't actually establish that social order itself, and that's the mistake, I think, that certain interpreters of these passages make. They confuse the message about how to live within a social order for a message about establishing that social order and its power relations in themselves.
I wonder though, Andrew, if you're not falling into what the critics of liberal theology suggest is a tendency for the church to want to keep up with trends in society rather than being the vessel of timeless truths.
Well, these things are always possible, of course, Andrew. Every person who's trying to struggle with Scripture to work out what its contemporary meaning is has to keep one eye on an unchanging reality, which we must believe is capable of being accessed through a serious and prayerful engagement with the text. But on the other hand, we have to consider the changed circumstances in which the texts are applied. And again, I'm afraid it's the slavery example that, you know, I have to come back to say that if slavery is an eternal verity, then perhaps we could really regard what this is saying about husbands and wives as an eternal verity as well. I have rarely heard people make that point seriously, although I have heard it once or twice, including from some Sydney theologians who say, well, we do really have slavery, it's because we have imprisonment, you know, because we have penal servitude, then we really still accept slavery, and so it's all right for us to accept the other institutions as well. And I think that's false, and I think that it's also morally repugnant, to be honest.
Now, Andrew, isn't there an inconsistency also, though, among liberals in the church who say that we need to be countercultural these days on things like capitalism, on the economic order of our society, the unfairness that it has spawned? We should be countercultural about that. We should be more faithful to the radical gospel of Jesus. And yet, you don't want to be countercultural on these social questions.
I do think that the principle that you're outlining there is a compelling one, namely that Christians have to be willing to be countercultural where the demands of the gospel require that. But we can't just leap over the question of determining what the demands of the gospel are in a given situation. I mean, in the 19th century, when the question of slavery arose in a very real way, and of course in the 18th century too, I guess, there were Christians, indeed evangelical Christians, who were in the forefront of saying that these particular passages, which seem to call for a particular social order, are not really to be read this way if we understand what the heart of the gospel message really is. So, you know, William Wilberforce was countercultural in his own way. The abolitionists of the 19th century United States were countercultural in their own particular way. Being countercultural or not isn't the point in itself. I think that a kind of fidelity to what we regard the heart of the gospel is the point.
Well, the Reverend Dr. Andrew McGowan, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Andrew.
And you can find interesting links to all the articles about this debate at our homepage on the RN website, where you can also leave a comment about this story. And that's where you'll find podcasts of all today's stories.